thanks for coming to the studio and congratulations on a book which seems to cover some of the biggest questions, such as where are we, who are we, and where are we going. A really simple question to begin with. Why did you write this book? What prompted you to write the book?
Well, look, it's a very good question. I wrote a big... Look, all of the books I write are really... They begin with me struggling with a problem or a question and wanting to understand it better. And I wanted to know a little bit about us as a society and as an organism in the context of planetary history. And I wanted to know what evolution could tell me about that. So really the book was an investigation for me of us, where we are now in relation to the planet and the bigger picture.
And so to do that, I suppose you go back to what is life? And you seem to disagree with the answer. Life is evolution, is the struggle for survival, where the fittest survive and pass on their genes. It's more than that?
Well, that's just a wrong interpretation of it, really, in the sense that the evolutionary mechanism is one, or a competitive one, that winnows out some individuals. And Darwin, Charles Darwin, and Richard Dawkins and others have written very elegantly on that. But understanding the mechanism is not a good basis, really, for deciding the bigger questions that we just talked about then. What you need to know if you're interested in those questions is, what is evolution's legacy? And Darwin and Dawkins are almost silent on that question. The person who really started looking into this first was a man called Alfred Russel Wallace, who was the co-founder of the theory of evolution with Darwin, and in 1903 wrote this incredible book called Man and the Universe, or Man's Place in the Universe, which is an extraordinary investigation, really, into just those questions of who are we, how do we relate to the planet, what is the planet, what is our future.
And the phrase heaven's performance comes up. Can you explain what you mean by heaven's performance when you're describing life on Earth?
Sure. Well, I think when we talk about evolution by natural selection, for the average person in the street, it doesn't mean anything. It's a black box, you know.
Yeah.
And there was a really famous Chinese scholar called Yan Fu, who actually developed the simplified Chinese alphabet at the end of the 19th century, who translated some works dealing with evolution. And the phrase he used, or the characters, Chinese characters he used to express evolution, can be read as heaven's performance. And I just thought it was such a beautiful and elegant way of explaining what this is about. The heavens, in this case, being everything in the old-fashioned meaning of the thing, you know. So, and it is, it's a performance, an unfolding performance, which is guided really by one rule, which is that information or information systems shape matter. And that really is, once you understand that and see how evolution fits into that, I think you can understand a lot about the planet and ourselves and our place in it.
And so how does that lead into seeing the Earth as James Lovelock saw it, as a kind of self-sustaining, integrated entity called Gaia?
Yeah, well, essentially the information system that shaped that entity is the genetic system, which is it's a binomial system. You know, it's only got the on-off code, you know, through the thing. So in that sense, it's a binary code like a computer, you know. And that coded system of information management has shaped Earth to an incredible extent, to the extent that the very continents that we reside on, it's recently been argued, result from the activities of life. And there is no doubt that the atmosphere in its current form was created by life. 99% of the gases in that atmosphere are a creation of life, as James Lovelock establishes. And, of course, the oceans in their current state are also made by life. They were never like that in the distant past. They were a toxic brew of chemicals and, you know, hostile to life. So the whole planet has been shaped by that information system coded in DNA.
And I suppose it's important that you start off the book by putting forward this picture of life on Earth, in the sense that a lot of people haven't really got their heads around the idea of life as a single living entity. And probably if they did, they might act differently in their relationships with the environment. You then go on to the human story, how we fit into life on Earth. And it's... History for you seems to be the big picture, all the way back millions of years through primate evolution. You then, after discussing some human history, jump into a discussion of cane toads moving across northern Australia, and then the parallel with humans moving across the earth, exterminating megafauna as they arrive on new continents, seems pretty striking to me. Was that intentional, that writing about cane toads and the progress of human civilizations? Oh,
very intentional. I mean, we are what we are, and we have been until very recently in our history a species that's been released from ecological constraint. And one of the, if you want to look at evolution's legacy and its most important aspect really, is coevolution. It's the way species work together to create what I call a commonwealth of virtue, a system whereby the interactions between species tend to preserve a balance in conditions as a whole. And this is what James Lovelock calls Gaia, whichever you want to call it. And we have upset that balance because we've escaped from evolution's constraints. And it often happens when a species comes to a new continent, and cane toads are just another great example of a species that's upset the balance by escaping the constraints of coevolution. You know, in South America, you're scratching to find a cane toad. They're not very common because things know how to eat them. They tolerate their poison, or else they avoid them. And, you know, a balance has been struck. Whereas here in Australia, nothing knows a cane toad's poisonous. So, you know, everything from freshwater crocodiles through to some of our birds and reptiles and mammals die from trying to eat them. And, of course, the cane toads just proliferate like rabbits or humans in a new environment.
Hmm. Do you think in the Australian context, because for a long time there seemed to be a debate amongst the experts about whether it was the arrival of humans 45 or so thousand years ago that caused the extinction of the megafauna. You think the debate's ended?
Look, I don't think it's ended. The debate goes on. But if you look at the global pattern, it's hard not to see the big picture there, because whatever the arguments in Australia, you know, the megafauna go extinct here, we know, 45,000 years ago or thereabouts, as the climate's gradually cooling. In the Americas, we know the megafauna go extinct about 13,000 years ago as the climate is rapidly warming. In New Zealand, they go extinct about 1,000 years ago. Madagascar, 2,000 years ago, under climatic conditions much like that of today. The one thing that links all of those extinctions is that those dates, 45,000, 13,000, 1 and 2,000, are when humans arrived in those respective lands. So the big picture says that really, it doesn't matter what the climate's doing. It can be cooling, it can be warming, it can be stable as it is today. The factor that really counts is the arrival of people. And I think that on the global, at least on the global scale, that is an irrefutable argument.
So you're saying that humans aren't the greatest stewards of nature in all instances, and yet you say that human species does seem to have a kind of biophilia, to use Edward O. Wilson's term. Can you expand on that? How do you see our biophilia manifest?
Well, look, let's put ourselves in the minds of those first hunters, you know, that came to Australia or North America. They lived in small tribal groups. They had no sense of the scale of the continent because they were just exploring it. No one had ever seen the full scale of it. And they wouldn't have known. The person who killed the last diprotodon would have had no idea he was consigning that species to extinction. So this is not an evil act in a sense. It's like the cane toads. It's not an evil act being eaten by a freshwater crocodile, right? It's an ecosystem out of balance. It's an ecosystem out of balance, and so I don't think we're inherently evil or we are destructive just because we're powerful and we can move around. But I do think that that phase is coming to an end now, and we are starting to fall back into a system of coevolution. And you can see that happening. It's a race, mind you, because there's still immensely destructive practices going on. But you can see the beginnings of an adaptation to a fully colonised world, I think, in humans now.
And you do mention in the book some of your experiences in Papua New Guinea. It seems like your time in the 80s in Papua New Guinea was more than just looking at tree kangaroos. Is that right?
Yeah. I was really interested in those human cultures, because those cultures have been co-evolving in place with their ecosystems for, 40,000 years. You know, the extinctions happened 45,000 years ago in New Guinea, around about, of the megafauna. And since then, people have had to live on what was left. And you see the most amazing cultural practices there. For example, in one area I was working, no one would eat the largest animals and fattiest and most tasty animals, like the giant echidna. No one would kill one, and as a result,
why was that?
Because, well, if you ask them why, they'd say, because our ancestors told us that that animal, and these things are nearly a metre long, they're like a giant echidna, but they, you know, weigh 16 kilograms, fatty big things. They'd say, you know, that our ancestors told us that that animal is our brother, and that when the first woman was alive on Earth, she had four children, and the echidna was one, and we were one. And the echidna, its eyes got sore because the smoke from the fire was always irritating it, because it got these little tiny weak eyes, you know. And she said to that child, you go off into the high mountains and live up there, and I'll tell my children never to harm you, because my other children, because you're one of us. And that's their reason for doing it, right?
Right.
But, and it's an incredibly strong thing for them, because men hunt individually. There would be nothing to prevent a guy going off and killing an echidna and eating it secretly and, you know, gaining all the benefit from doing that. But people just don't do it. And because the echidnas were common, you know, up until the missionaries came along. And I think it's because they really do believe that by killing an echidna, they would invite catastrophe to the whole of their people. But from an environmental perspective, those arguments, the stated reasons for not doing something are not really sufficient. And because I've seen this pattern again and again in Melanesia, I think what it may be about is protecting biodiversity and protecting keystone species that play a vital role in ecosystems. Because if the ecosystem's healthy as a whole, the human civilization that depends upon that ecosystem is also likely to be healthy. And it's interesting that in that area that I mentioned where the giant echidna was protected, those people were particularly successful. They were pushing out into other areas and were quite a force to be reckoned with. So I wonder if that's because they had a healthy ecosystem. I can't prove it, but I can point to a link.
So in that case, environmental sustainability isn't all about regulation and technology. It's culture and belief has a strong part to play.
Unbelievably strong, because no amount of regulation imposed from the outside can protect an animal like that. We see it with rhinos. You know, they're being poached from under our eyes, despite the implementation of the most high-tech approaches and, you know, millions of dollars being thrown at it. Very difficult, but belief will do that.
One wonders how that kind of belief in environmental sustainability might enter our Western Australian societies, maybe seeing a culture of conspicuous consumption. Seeing that culture might end in Australia is wishful thinking, I don't know, but that seems to be what we need.
I think people have got a pretty good moral compass, you know, by and large, and that moral compass is formed in the forge of evolution by natural selection, you know. It is part of us in that sense, and it has a purpose in our lives. And when we see things like wanton destruction of the environment, it pricks that conscience of ours. And you know, I do think that we will form a belief-based system ultimately, which will protect our environment. But we're starting from scratch at the moment, so it's not easy.
Some of the problems of the world. I'll skip through this section quickly as we're running out of time. But population is one of the major problems you discuss as facing the world, and you see the education of women, that I think many demographers have talked about as being a solution to overpopulation.
You know, there's very interesting things to say about global population growth. For example, the fact that we are self-regulating. We are the only self-regulating species in terms of population that evolution has ever produced. 4.5 billion years of evolution, no other species has done it. And our species has done it and is now, just in the span of 150 years... going to regulate its population globally. The entire human family will have passed through the demographic transition between about 1900 and 2050. And that is an incredible phenomenon. I can't, as I say it, the hairs on the back of my neck stand on end, because I can't believe that that is the outcome.
And I guess the question is, can we take the load?
Well, that's a very, very good question. But even more important is, why is it so? Why is it so? Why is our species the only one in 4.5 billion years of evolution ever to do this? And I can't answer exactly, but I can point to another strange fact, which is that we are now acting as a global intelligence. We have the potential as a species to act as a global intelligence. Brains, of course, as the command and control systems for bodies, have to be self-regulating. Otherwise, they'd keep growing and take all of the energy that a body had to offer, and then the whole organism would die. command and control systems have to be self-regulating. And it strikes me as being amazing that our species, which is assuming the role of at least beginning intelligent regulation of the planet, is the only one ever to have developed self-regulation. I find that there's some underlying laws there that we do not understand, which are of the utmost importance to us as a species, I think.
Hmm. Just quickly, you do also talk about ant superorganisms, colonies of ants in reasonable depth in an earlier part of the book, and then go on to use the metaphor of a superorganism to describe human civilizations and societies. How do you think we're well described as a superorganism today?
It's not a metaphor.
Literally, you think we're a superorganism?
We are. Of course we are. We have all of the characteristics of the ant superorganisms. The only difference is that insect superorganisms are held together by genetic similarity. That is the glue, the superorganismic glue that binds individuals to other individuals. Ours is a civilizational superorganism of ideas. And both are evolved entities. Termite colonies evolved from cockroaches, you know, ants evolved from wasps and things. We also evolved. No one planned this civilization of ours. No one directed it. It is a direct result of the evolutionary process in exactly the same way that an ant colony is. And the same rules that guide it in broad principle are guiding the evolution of our superorganism as well. You know, even to the, I would argue, to the way we use the internet and what it's doing to our society now. These are profound shifts, changes that are welding the superorganism, the human superorganism, together in a way it's never been welded and coordinated before.
And how does rampant economic rationalism and individualism fit into that view? People who espouse that and follow that road in life?
Well, you know, how do willful, unruly, upright apes get to cooperate? That's the question, in effect, you're asking me. How does that rampant individualism and selfishness coexist with the idea of a superorganism, right? Because in an ant superorganism, the interests of any individual ant is entirely consonant with the interests of the ant colony as a whole. There is no difference between me and us in terms of aspirations or anything else. Humans, it's very different. We are important individually. So what are the mechanisms that we have evolved and developed to allow unruly, upright, selfish apes to cooperate? And they are a market, for a start. You know, they are the democratic process, which everyone has a role in. We can see in the growth of democracy, even now in the Middle East, just this week, how powerful these new phenomena are in shaping us. I think, you know, that there's no doubt that for the last 10,000 years we've been on this journey towards superorganism status. We've now achieved global superorganism status. And we are becoming, we'll never be like ants, but the glue that holds us together now is becoming inseparable.
Okay, well, I'd just like to ask you about your visit to Western Australia. You're appearing tomorrow in Perth at the University of Western Australia as part of the Perth Writers' Festival. I think it's 9:30 tomorrow morning, is that Saturday morning, is that right?
That's correct, yeah. And I'm doing another gig about lunchtime on Saturday. I'm doing a few different things for the festival, and it looks like a great festival. You've got some marvellous guests.
Before we leave, the Climate Commission and your role in it, what's going on?
Well, look, the Climate Commission was set up by the federal government as a result of an election promise. And the idea of the commission is to engage in a dialogue with the Australian public about climate science, the state of the international negotiations, where they are, and the options before us in terms of putting a price on the pollution, you know, the greenhouse gas pollution. So that's going to be the job for the next couple of years, is getting out there, just talking to people around the country, really, and in Parliament about these issues. So we shall see how it goes.
Well, good luck. I guess this radio interview is part of that process.
It is.
Thanks for talking to Understory. That was Tim Flannery.